Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can be done to save a small-sized species that performs a gigantic service in the ecosystem on commercial farms and in our backyard gardens? Bumblebees, with their large, fuzzy bodies, broad taste in flowers, and tolerance for cold weather, are great natural pollinators within the insect world. But bumblebee populations are in decline in numerous places, in part due to human development in areas that once formed their natural habitat. My guest today formed the Bumblebee Conservation Trust in order to fight that decline and to help reintroduce lost species to environments from which they have vanished in recent years. Dave Goulson is professor of biological and environmental sciences at the University of Sussex. His new book is called A Sting in the Tail, My Adventures with Bumblebees. Dave, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much.
Let's start with the basics. How do bumblebees differ from honeybees?
So bumblebees, if you ask a child to draw a bee, they'll draw something that's big and fat and has yellow and black stripes. And that's basically a bumblebee. So they're much bigger than honeybees, which are quite slender, not very furry, and generally brownish. They have a slightly different life cycle as well, and there are lots of other differences. But to look at, they're much bigger, furrier, and to my mind, rather cuter.
Yeah, they are cuter, and they don't sting as much, right?
They don't. They're perfectly capable of it, but they're very placid, docile creatures. They only sting if you really, really give them good cause.
And they build nests instead of hives, is that right?
Yeah, so these are wild bees. I mean, lots of people don't realize that there's lots of species of bee. You know, I think a lot of people think there's probably just one species and it lives in a box and it makes honey. But actually, there are something like 22,000 species of bee in the world, of which 250 are bumblebees. Unlike most of those species, are little solitary things that nobody ever notices, and they live on their own. They don't live in a nest at all. They just live up, you know, solitary lives. But bumblebees are a bit more like honeybees. They have a nest with a queen and worker bees, but it's rather smaller, just a couple of hundred workers at when it's fully grown, whereas a honeybee hive can contain 40,000-50,000 workers, so hugely bigger. And bumblebee nests are wild. They're out there. They're usually underground, down a hole in the ground. You hardly ever see them. You might just disturb one occasionally in a compost heap, or if you're knocking down a garden shed, you might find one underneath, but usually you never see them. But they are there around and about, living out their lives all around us.
And they're incredibly good at pollinating, in part because of the differences in their bodies and the fact that they come in different shapes and sizes, right?
Yeah, so different bees kind of fit different flowers. You know, they evolved over the millennia with different flowers. And bumblebees come in a range of sizes themselves, or they all tend to be quite big. But particularly the length of the tongue differs. So we've got all these different species. Some have really long tongues, some shorter tongues. And that determines what flowers they visit. So things like broad beans and runner beans and red clover have got really deep flowers, and so they tend to be visited by the really long-tongued bumblebees. And hardly any other bees can visit and pollinate those plants. Some of them are a bit shorter-tongued and visit shallower flowers. And so, yeah, they kind of carve up the world of flowers between them by largely on the basis of the lengths of their tongues.
And they leave behind a little chemical signal after they have exhausted the nectar there is to be found in a particular flower.
Yeah, so this is one of the first kind of interesting things that I discovered when I started working on bumblebees 20 years ago. They're really good at collecting nectar and pollen. That's all that all bees do, basically. And so they've evolved to be really, really efficient at it. And so years and years ago, I was sitting in a meadow in the south of England, and I noticed bees, something that anyone can see in their backyard, anywhere in the world where there are bumblebees. If you watch a bee on a patch of flowers, it flies about, but it quite often flies up to a flower, but then doesn't actually land on it. It's just at the last minute it kind of veers away, and it might do that two or three times before it lands on a flower. And I saw this, and I thought, what are they doing? You know, what's making them do that? And to cut a long story short, and it took about 5 years of me and a PhD student working on this, we eventually worked out that basically every time a bee lands on a flower, it just accidentally leaves behind a little kind of smelly footprint, just like when we touch a wine glass, we leave behind a little smear of a fingerprint. And if a bee has visited a flower, then it will have taken the rewards, the nectar will be gone, and it will take a few hours for the flower to replace them. So that there's no point in another bee landing. And if it can detect empty flowers from this faint whiff of previous bee, then the bee can save itself a fraction of a second that it would otherwise spend landing and putting its tongue into an empty flower. So it's one of their kind of, you know, little tricks that they use to maximize the amount of food they can collect.
Well, I love that story because we've all seen that, right? Everybody has observed bees doing exactly what you just described. Can you talk about, one of the reasons I suppose that they've evolved to do this is that they need to eat an awful lot just to stay alive. They could starve to death within under an hour if they haven't had anything.
Yeah, bumblebees are particularly kind of interesting beasts because they're adapted to cold weather. They can fly around when the air temperature is quite close to freezing, and some species live right up into the Arctic Circle. And the reason they can do that is because they flap their wings really fast, 200 times a second or thereabouts to stay in the air. And all that muscle contraction in their body creates lots of heat, and they keep that in with their fur. And that's basically why they can fly around in early spring and when no other insects are able to fly at all, and why they live in cold climates. But the downside of it is it takes huge amounts of energy to do all that wing flapping. And so they need lots and lots of flowers. So someone, not me, but someone once worked out that a running man uses the calories in a Mars bar in about an hour of going for a run. Mm-hmm. If you had a man-sized bumblebee, he would burn the calories in a Mars bar in 30 seconds of flying. It would also be quite scary, but it illustrates how much energy they need to stay in the air. And obviously, if they can't find flowers, that's their only source of all that energy. Then they eventually run out of quite quickly. About 40 minutes it takes for a bumblebee to start to starve. And once it's run out of energy, it can't fly anymore. And once it can't fly, it can't get to flowers. So basically, at that point, it's probably had it. Mm. And you do occasionally see rather sad-looking bees wandering along on the ground. And it's because they've basically run out of food, and they're probably doomed.
Is it true that bumblebees should not be able to fly with those big fat bodies and those little tiny wings?
That's a sort of one of those urban legends or whatever. Nobody can pin down where this supposed saying that bumblebees shouldn't be able to fly came from. I don't think anyone credible anyway ever said it, but somehow it's kind of, it's a tale that's in the popular story that's in the popular conscious, but nobody knows where it came from, and clearly isn't true. No one's told the bees, anyway.
My guest is Dave Goulson. He's professor of biological and environmental sciences at the University of Sussex and author of the new book, A Sting in the Tail, My Adventures with Bumblebees. We'll talk more about them and about threats to bumblebees taking place now. In just a couple of minutes, you can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. In the meantime, we want to update you on the status of the challenge we have going. Robert Verdon, Dallas attorney and good friend of KERA, has said he will give the station $1,500 if we can raise $10,000 during the 2 hours of Think Today. We're on the second hour now. We have $4,913 left to raise in order to receive this extra money. So please, if you haven't made your contribution yet, now is the time to do it at KERA.org or 1-888-694-6931. And when you do, if you'd like to make a $120 contribution, $10 a month, we can send you a copy of Dave Goulson's fascinating fun book, A Sting in the Tail. Hello, Jeff Whittington.
Hey, Chris. You can pick up your very own copy of this book with a $10 a month contribution. And when you make your contribution by calling 888-694-6931, when you call the toll-free number 888-694-6931, or when you make a gift to the station online at kera.org, you're automatically entered into this grand prize drawing. It's going to be tomorrow, which is the last day of the membership campaign. We're going to give away two seats to see Neil deGrasse Tyson's sold-out appearance at the Windspear Opera House. And we're also going to throw in a $1,000 Apple Store gift card It's a pretty great opportunity for someone. Someone's going to win this. When you make your contribution, you're automatically entered into the drawing.
It's awesome to be able to think, for all of you who've already made your contributions, right, that your name's there. It could very well be the one that we draw out of there. And regardless, you will know that you get a year of great radio. Perhaps you've chosen a thank you gift. It's the perfect time to make your contribution. And you will be helping the station get this additional $1,500. Hopefully, if we can raise $10,000 by the time the show ends in about 43 minutes. So now's the time to take action at KERA.org or 1-888-694-6931.
$4,913 left to raise by 2 o'clock. Or we have to say thanks but no thanks to Robert Verdon. He's a Dallas attorney. He's a friend of KERA. He's a big listener and supporter of the station. And he has issued a challenge to you, the listeners of Think today, for us to raise, with your help, $10,000 in the 2 hours of the show today. Your contribution right now at 888-694-6931 will help us get there. Or you can do it online at KERA.org. This is a $1,500 challenge. Robert will give the station an additional $1,500 if you'll give. And if we can just raise this remaining $4,913, which I think we can do, but we do need to hear from you right now.
Your contribution to the station is risk-free, right? Because you've been listening for all this time. You know what you're going to get on KERA. You know the expanding services available to you at KERA.org on our news site. You know the quality of the programming that you get from National Public Radio and also from locally produced programs here at KERA. Your dollars simply pay for all that and keep it out there. KERA.org or 1-888-694-6931. And who knows? You might just win a $1,000 Apple Store gift card. But wait, that's not the end of the prize. Also, two tickets to see Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah, it's a pretty great opportunity, and someone's going to win. This is the kind of deal where you have to get in the drawing to win, and you have to support KERA to help make it a success. By the way, the Neil deGrasse Tyson event is on May 19th at the Winspear Opera House. And of course, your Apple Store gift card for $1,000, if you win that, you're able to just walk right in.
Could start, be the best day ever, right?
Start picking stuff up. Yeah, it's a pretty great prize. There are all kinds of things you can get for $1,000 at the Apple Store. The thing you can't get is tickets to the sold-out event with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, unless you are the lucky winner. So if you haven't given to the station yet, this is your opportunity right now. Call 888-694-6931 or click and join at KERA.org. And don't forget, we've got copies of this book available with a $10 a month contribution.
We're getting close enough to completing the challenge. We have $4,668 left to raise. Close enough to completing it that I'm feeling enthused and excited, but not so close that I feel like we can let our guard down and relax, right? Don't be thinking, okay, great, they don't need me. They're close enough. They'll definitely get it. You know, $4,600 is a lot of money. Your contribution now of $10 or $20 a month will really make a difference. And goodness, if you could join at the Friends member level, $1,500 or $125 a month, that would be really great and would get us a little bit closer to the point where we could, feel very confident.
Maybe you're already a friend of KERA and it's time for you to renew your Friends membership. This would be a great opportunity. Yeah. You're planning on renewing your Friends membership anyway. This would be a great opportunity for you to do that and help us make this goal. $4,543 left to raise. Really, Chris, that's three Friends memberships at the $1,500 level. And then we'll sew this up. So be the next one to call 888-694-6931, 1-888-694-6931, or go to KERA.org.
You can also get a copy of Dave Golson's fascinating, really interesting, and sometimes even funny book, A Sting in the Tail, My Adventures with Bumblebees. That's available as a thank you gift, among others, when you join at the level of $10 a month or more. So do it now at KERA.org or 1-888-694-6931. Back in 2 minutes with Dave Golson.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dave Goulson. He is professor of biological and environmental sciences at the University of Sussex. He is founder of the Bumblebee Conservation Trust and author of the new book, A Sting in the Tail, My Adventures with Bumblebees. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Dave, when did it become apparent that bumblebee populations are in decline?
Well, so there's been lots of talk about bees declining for a number of years now. Some of it focused on honeybees. Beekeepers are usually the first people that notice if there's any problems with bees because they obviously their livelihood depends on it. Bumblebees, we think have been probably declining, probably all bees, for 70 or 80 years. This is not new. But I don't think anyone really started to notice anything until maybe the 1990s, when the first signs that they were really doing badly started to kind of show up. And in the UK, we noticed that because some species were just disappearing from the whole, well, from big chunks of the UK. And in fact, some of them have gone extinct. We've lost three species of the 25 we used to have here. And there have been similar patterns in the US, in fact, across North America. Some of your species that used to be really common, bees that you'd see in your backyard all over North America, declined really rapidly about 15 years ago, actually. And some North America had the most recent global bumblebee extinction, a rather beautiful thing called Franklin's bumblebee, which used to live in Northern California and Oregon, went extinct, so far as we know. It hasn't been seen since 2006, and there were none of those left anywhere in the world. So they're not doing so well is the long and the short of it.
And in the UK, at least, you can blame Hitler, at least indirectly.
Well, yeah, I do blame Hitler partly in my book. And that might sound a bit silly, but it's not entirely unjustified. So basically the link is that if you could go back 100 years in Britain, you'd see a landscape that was full of flowery hay meadows and hedges and wildflowers and so on, where today there are very, very few flowers. And then that change really kicked off during the Second World War when Britain was isolated. It was very difficult to get food from anywhere. Importing it from North America was difficult because there were U-boats in the Atlantic and so on. And so Britain had a Dig for Victory campaign. We encouraged everybody to grow as much food as they could. We encouraged farmers to rip out all those hedges, to plow up all those flowery meadows and turn them all over into arable fields and so on, which, you know, made a lot of sense in 1942. But we carried on with those changes right through to the 1990s, and that sort of 50 years of slowly destroying the countryside, or at least turning it from a countryside that was rich in wildlife and flowers and bees and butterflies and birds and so on, into a countryside which is producing a lot of food but not doing a lot else. That's the big cause of bee declines. There have been some other big issues relating to pesticides and diseases and so on more recently, but the long-term decline is all down to this kind of habitat change. And in Britain, at least, then it all kicked off with Hitler.
Even things like industrialization, the fact that there aren't so many horses around for transportation, so farm fields are not, there aren't so many clover fields as they used to be. And it really is true, I guess, that bees really dig clover.
They do. I mean, the one thing I when I'm trying to persuade farmers to explain to them what they can do, the simplest thing they can do is just sow a field with red clover. You can use it as a lay crop. It boosts the soil fertility. You get a much bigger yield the following year. And people used to use clover in crop rotations just like that. And also because, as you say, horses used to still love clover. But of course, horses used to be vitally important to farming before mechanization. But these days, obviously, farmers, the horses are just for fun, and most farmers don't have them, and so there's no need for all that clover that we used to grow.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So can you talk a little bit about the different jobs that bumblebees do to contribute to the collective welfare of their colonies?
Yeah. So the colony started by a queen who's much bigger than the rest of the nest in the spring. And to start with, she has to do everything herself. But then once she's got her first batch of workers reared up, they're all her daughters, they take over all of the foraging, which is kind of the most dangerous job in the nest. And the queen from that point on never leaves her nest again and leaves all the foraging to her daughter workers. And the nest grows through the season, and in summer it produces new queens and males. The people usually find this quite amusing, but the males in bumblebees and all bees don't do any work in the nest. Their sole job in life is to mate. They fly out of the nest pretty much as soon as they're old enough to fly and hang around on flowers, drinking nectar and keeping an eye out for passing virgin queens that they can mate with. So all the work in the nest is done by the female daughters of the queen. And they each specialize in different jobs. So some will go out collecting food. Some specialize in looking after the little ones in the nest. Some specialize in keeping the nest cool when it's too hot by fanning their wings and so on. So they carve up all the jobs in the nest between them.
How far do they wander from their nests in order to find nectar?
We spent years studying this. It's a surprisingly hard thing to find out, actually, because you'd think it's kind of, well, you know, you just watch them, see where they go or something. But actually, of course, they fly really quick. You can't follow them. Mm-hmm. So you can have a nest in your garden or whatever, and you see the bees zooming out, and then you see them, you can mark the individual bees, and you can see those same bees coming back after maybe half an hour or sometimes an hour. But finding what patch of flowers they're on is really difficult. We tried the obvious approach of marking the bees in a nest and then looking for them on flowers. Didn't seem to work. They were going so far that we just couldn't find them. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack. People have tried all sorts of things. They've tried sticking radar aerials on their back, but that doesn't really work terribly well because the technology isn't the radar. The aerials are too big, too heavy, or this radar isn't sensitive enough and the bees fly off the edge of the screen and so on. In the end, we pieced together enough evidence to give us a pretty good idea. In part, I did lots of homing experiments where I took poor bees and marked them. I had some nests in my garden, and I drove them around the countryside and released them at different distances, a bit like people do with pigeons, mm-hmm. to see if they can get back again. And so I'd release these poor bees in places that they may never have seen before. And then I'd drive home and I'd sit by the nest to see if they got back. And they were surprisingly good at it. The record, I think, was about 7 miles, which when you think that, these are worker bumblebees that weigh 0.2 of a gram or something, and they're half an inch long, and they're able to navigate across country that far. It's pretty phenomenal. So the long and the short of it is we think that they routinely go a mile or two, but occasionally if food is scarce and they need to go further, they can go 3, 4, 5 miles to find patches of flowers and to bring the nectar back, which I think is pretty amazing, you know, that they can navigate with their... At the end of the day, their brain is quite tiny, but they're seemingly capable of feats of navigation that many of us would fail to manage.
So what's your best guess as to how they navigate?
Well, we know quite a lot about what they do. They can use the sun as a compass. If the sun's not visible, they have a kind of inbuilt magnetic compass somehow. We don't know how they sense it, but they can tell where is north purely from the Earth's magnetic field. But probably the most useful thing they do is they memorize the big objects, prominent landmarks. And they memorize the position of those relative to their home, their nest. Hmm. So if there are big trees or tall buildings or telegraph posts or whatever, they memorize each of them and its location relative to home. So as soon as they see one of those things, they immediately know the way home and they can fly back in just a few few minutes in a beeline, hence the word, straight back. So for a little time, the brain of a bee is a fraction of the size of a grain of rice, and yet it's capable of memorizing quite complicated landscapes and over, you know, an area of several miles around their home, which I must admit never ceases to amaze me.
And one of the ways you figured this out was by sort of planting some mobile landmarks that you could move around and see how the bees responded.
Yeah, to be fair, it wasn't me. That was some other folk who did this really interesting, clever work where they absolutely. You make a plywood tree cut out of a tree or whatever on rollers, and you put it near the nest, and the bees get used to it, and they use it as one of their landmarks on the way home. And then you move it, you take it 100 yards north, and you see what happens. And of course, the bees are initially fooled; they use that to orientate themselves, and so they think their nest is 100 meters or 100 yards north of where it really is, or whatever. But after a few minutes, they work out their mistake and find their way back. They're smart enough to not be fooled for long. But that's one of the ways that we worked out how they use these landmarks.
Dave Goulson is founder of the Bumblebee Conservation Trust, and he is professor of biological and environmental sciences at the University of Sussex. We're talking about his new book, A Sting in the Tail, My Adventures with Bumblebees. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. We'll come back to our conversation with Dave in a few minutes. In the meantime, if you would like to pick up a copy of his book, A Sting in the Tail, we have it available as a thank you gift when you make a contribution at or above the level of just $10 a month. You'll be helping KERA, you will help yourself to a year of great radio, and you will make it possible for everybody else in the community. 1-888-694-6931 is the number. You can also go to kera.org, make a contribution online. Hey, Jeff, do you have an update on how we're doing on the challenge?
Let's see. It looks like $3,612 left to raise.
Okay, great.
By 2 o'clock. We started with a goal of $10,000 in the two-hour show at noon today, and the reason we're trying to raise $10,000 is because Robert Verdon, a Dallas attorney, has issued a challenge to you, my friends of Think, to make a contribution today. If we raise $10,000, he'll give an additional $1,500 to KERA. We can't afford to let this slip away, so please call right now at 888-694-6931. Please go online to kera.org and make your contribution. Make your voice heard. Support this forum that you listen to, that you use every single day.
Thank you so much, James McGee in Dallas, for your contribution. We appreciate Lucy Brandon in Wichita Falls, Linda Ellington in Flower Mound. Thank you, Duquan Kim in Coppell, Netta Moyad in Colleyville, and Rob Laney in Fort Worth. Thanks to all of you. Maybe you all are some of the reason that we're down to $3,577.
I want to thank Dorothy Beam and Ben Brook and Lynn Davis Colwell and Purden and James Wang in Dallas. Also, we heard from Susan Rebellier, or maybe it's Rebellet, in Dallas, and Timothy Forsberg in Bedford. And thanks also to Megan Perrick in Fort Worth. You're the folks that are making this possible. You know, we have bills to pay here at KERA, not just equipment to repair and replace and purchase in the first place, but you know, utility bills, the phone bill. You know, we're on the phone to the UK today to talk to Dave Goulson. Last hour, we were on a high quality ISDN line to California, and we have to pay for that studio time in order to line up these interviews, in order to make these high quality phone calls so that it sounds like the guest is right here with you. This is a change that we've made with Think. We're actually pursuing the clear line as much as possible, whenever possible. And our ultimate goal is to have every guest in a studio, if not here in the studio with Chris, in a studio somewhere else around the world. Well, that costs money, and you're helping to support that when you make your contribution. That's why we really need to raise this $10,000. That's why we really need to get this $1,500 challenge in the door. So call us at 888-694-6931 or do it online at kera.org.
And today, when we take your contribution either on online or over the phone. Immediately after that, somebody takes your name, writes it down, and drops it into the barrel that we'll be drawing from tomorrow for our grand prize winner. We have two tickets to see Neil deGrasse Tyson at the Winspear Opera House and a $1,000 Apple Store gift card. All this goes to the same lucky winner, who is also someone who has likely supported the station over the past couple of days. 1-888-694-6931 is the number to make sure that your name is in that drawing. You can also do it with a contribution at KERA.org.
Lots of numbers. $10,000 goal, $1,500 challenge, $1,000 gift card. Neil deGrasse Tyson at the Winspear on May 19th. But the only number you really need to know right now is 888-694-6931.
I would add one more. 21 minutes until the show is over. So that's the end of the challenge. If we, of course, your money will make a difference no matter what, but it will not help us with this challenge from Robert Verdon unless we do it by the end of Think Today. So we have $3,527 left to go. Not too much time to do it. So if you could please take action now, someone else who wants to come in and be in that last $1,000, maybe we'll do it if we can get down to that last $1,000.
888-694-6931, online at KERA.org. $3,462 left to go. Your contribution at the $10 a month level will get you a copy of Dave Goulson's book, A Sting in the Tail, all about the bumblebees. It's a really great read, and what a great conversation. I want to get back to this conversation. We're going to get back to it here shortly, but we're waiting to hear from you at 888-694-6931.
The very fact that when we start doing fundraising, you say to yourself, oh, no, here it comes. I really just want to listen to Think uninterrupted. That proves how much you value the service and how much the station means to you. So please consider making a contribution in any amount at KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931.
888-694-6931. 1-888-694-6931. Or go online to KERA.org. Don't forget, somebody's going to win tickets to see Neil deGrasse Tyson on May 19th at the Winspear here in Dallas and a $1,000 Apple Store gift card. But we've got to raise this $3,462 left in the $10,000 goal in order to receive the $1,500 challenge from Robert Verdon.
Update, we are down to $3,277 left to raise. Your contribution now will make a big difference. And who knows, you'll be in that drawing to win the tickets to Neil deGrasse Tyson and the $1,000 Apple Store gift card. Maybe you'll win. KERA.org or 1-888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dave Goulson, professor of biological and environmental sciences at the University of Sussex and founder of the Bumblebee Conservation Trust. His new book is called A Sting in the Tail, My Adventures with Bumblebees. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Dave, we've talked a lot about how bumblebees interact with their environment. What do they do? Remind us of what they do for us and how they help us live in the world that we do.
Yeah, so about three-quarters of all the crops that we eat globally are pollinated by insects, and the majority of those by bees of one sort or another. And bumblebees are an important part of that. So just as an example, pretty much every tomato that you or I have eaten since 1988 would almost certainly have been pollinated by a bumblebee, not any other kind of bee. Blueberries, raspberries, runner beans, strawberries, cranberries, all of those are mainly pollinated by bumblebees, and then lots of other vegetables are partly pollinated by them. So they perform a really important job. If we didn't have those bumblebees, then our diets would be much more boring. And so we have an obvious strong incentive to make sure we look after them.
And if we don't have bumblebees, as in places like Australia, those tomatoes have to be hand-pollinated?
Yeah, it's bizarre. So if we were to go back 30 years and you were to go to a commercial tomato grower anywhere in the world, they have these huge glass houses where they have sometimes dozens or even hundreds of acres under glass of tomatoes. And they were hand-pollinated by people. They employed people with a vibrating wand to wander around and buzz every flower. Basically, you have to vibrate every flower on the tomato to pollinate it. And then in the 1980s, a Belgian guy, who's actually a vet, strangely enough, he worked out two things. One was that bumblebees are really good at pollinating tomatoes, much better than people with vibrating sticks. And he also worked out how to breed them, how to rear colonies that he could sell. And within two or three years, that something that started out as a business he was running from his shed in the garden turned into an international multi-million pound trade. And now literally millions of bumblebee nests are reared in factories and shipped all over the world for tomato pollination. Hence, every tomato you eat is pollinated by a bumblebee, unless you live in Australia, which is the only place left in the world, really, where there are no bumblebees, either introduced or native. And in Australia, the poor guys still have to hand-pollinate every tomato with their vibrating wands.
It does not sound like a fun job.
No, it doesn't, does it?
All right, 1-800-933-5372 if you'd like to ask a question. We have Noel on the line in Burleson. Hi, Noel.
Hi.
Oh, Noel, hi. Hi, good to have you.
Thank you. I would like to start a colony. I've just started gardening again. And I'd like to start a colony of bumblebees. How can I do that?
Okay, so you can buy, certainly in Britain, and I think they sell them in the US, you can buy bumblebee nest boxes, which are empty boxes that you put in a quiet corner of the garden, and if you're lucky, a bumblebee might nest in them. I wouldn't really recommend them, to be honest, because all the ones I've seen don't really work very often, and 9 times out of 10, you end up with a box that might have a spider in it, and that's about it. I think a better bet is to try and make nest sites yourself. At least then, if they don't work, they haven't cost you anything. Actually, one of the best things you can provide for bumblebees nesting is an old undisturbed compost heap. If you compost and then just leave it for a year or so, they seem to absolutely love that. I guess the extra warmth from the rotting material helps to keep the nest warm. And that's where most bumblebee nests in gardens, you tend to find them. You can also make a nest site if you just scoop out a little hole in the ground and cover it with a paving slab or a plank, put in an old mouse nest or a bird's nest if you can, and they might take to that. It wouldn't have cost you anything if they don't. I don't thoroughly recommend the bought versions of bumblebee nest boxes.
I was surprised to learn that a lot of the new and improved sort of hybrid plants and flowers that we can buy at the gardening center might look good, but they're not so good for bumblebees.
No, they're not. I mean, they're sort of, we call them annual bedding plants. I don't know whether they go by the same term over there, but you get these things like busy lizzies and begonias and petunias and pansies and whatever. They're really brightly colored annuals that you buy every spring and you plant them out, and they flower for ages, but you don't see any insects on them at all, and it's because they've been really intensively bred for large flowers, often for multiple extra sets of petals. You get these double flowers, all for whatever the plant breeder wanted, and very often they've lost the pollen and the nectar, or they've become such a weird shape that insects can't get into them anymore. Mm. So, from a bee's perspective, you might as well have plastic flowers in your garden as grow these things. And it's much, much, much better, in my view and the bee's view, if instead of those you grow a few more sort of old-fashioned cottage garden perennials and herbs, things like marjoram and lavender and sage and rosemary and thyme and lupins and aquilegia and so on. There's a long, long list of lovely flowers you can grow that your bees will really thank you for.
It's great to know, because I think a lot of people think, oh, I've put in this lovely garden, surely it's good for bees, and have not realized what, you know,
yeah,
what
it's kind of sad that not all flowers are good for bees, but there are many lovely ones that are. Another kind of related, slightly worrying issue is that a lot of the plants that you might buy from garden centers have been treated with insecticides before you get them. So it's really sad to think that sometimes people might be buying plants to try and feed their bees and actually poisoning them by mistake.
So a long time ago, Dave, bees were exported essentially from the UK to New Zealand. They thrived in New Zealand, and now there's an effort to repatriate some of those bees back to the UK.
Yeah, it's a fascinating and weird story, which I'd better cut really short. But so there's a species called the short-haired bumblebee, which was one of the 25 native species in the UK, and it went extinct in the late 1980s, basically because of intensive farming and no flowers and so on. But by a quirk of fate, there are British short-haired bumblebees still alive in the world in New Zealand. So in 1895, a farmer in New Zealand, he couldn't work out why every time he sowed red clover, it never set any seed. They imported lots of red clover to grow as a fodder crop for their horses and animals and whatnot, and it wasn't setting any seed. So they kept having to re-import this really expensive seed from the other side of the world. Eventually someone twigged it was because there weren't any bumblebees in New Zealand naturally, so there was nothing to pollinate the clover. And so this guy wrote a letter to his cousin who lived in Kent, which is in the southeast of England, not far from where I am, and said, could you send me some bumblebees? And this guy duly did. He put them on a refrigerated ship, and so they introduced a whole bunch of bumblebees to New Zealand, and one of the ones that they introduced, just by chance, is the short-haired bumblebee, and it survived there to this very day, which prompted the idea that we could actually bring them back and reintroduce them to the UK.
And how's that going?
Well, so I not as brilliant. It's good in some ways. So basically, slightly disappointingly, we eventually actually gave up on the idea of reintroducing them from New Zealand for the reason that. It turns out we did some genetic studies of the New Zealand population, and it's terribly inbred. They have very little genetic variation. Mm. And we think that entire New Zealand population was founded probably just from two queens originally taken from Britain. So they weren't really suitable in the end, sadly, to reintroduce to Britain. So instead we switched to bringing them back from Sweden, which is the only place left in Europe with a good population of short-haired bumblebees. And so we duly brought some back, having created lots of new habitat. So 2 years ago, 2012, we released 50-odd short-haired bumblebee queens back in Kent, and they flew off, and we never saw any of them again. It was a terrible summer. It rained the whole time, and we think they all died. So we released a whole bunch more last year, 2013, and this time, 2 months after the release, we finally saw worker short-haired bumblebees on the wing in Britain, which was the first time in 30 years, which was really exciting. But we don't know whether those nests did well enough to produce new queens and males, and whether, if they did, hopefully the mated queens would be hibernating in the ground right now, and towards the end of May, we would expect them to come out of hibernation. So we're kind of waiting on tenterhooks to see whether we've been successful or not. If not, then we'll continue bringing them in from Sweden for a few more years yet and see if we can finally establish them a nice, healthy population back in the UK.
Well, we're sending good thoughts from this side of the Atlantic.
Thank you.
Dave Goulson is Professor of Biological and Environmental Sciences at the University of Sussex and founder of the Bumblebee Conservation Trust. His new book is called A Sting in the Tail, My Adventures with Bumblebees. Dave, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for making time for us.
It was absolutely my pleasure.
Thanks to all of you listening today. Thanks especially to those of you who have brought us down on our challenge. We started the Think Show today needing to raise $10,000. We need to raise $1,612 as it stands. And if we do, we will receive an additional $1,500 from Dallas attorney Robert Verdon, who said he would give the station that money if we raised $10,000 during the 2 hours of Think today. And we received a friends level contribution in the last few minutes. So thank you so much. Really appreciate that. Remember that if you become a friend, in addition to other benefits we have throughout the year, you will receive a large number of American Airlines Advantage miles, 7,500 of them.
Yeah, it's a really great opportunity for you to support the station at a level that makes a huge difference. Does that say $1,489?
I believe it does. So in the next few minutes, you will basically, thanks to Robert Verdon, your contribution goes twice as far.
Yeah, if you can make a friends level contribution right now, if it's time for you to renew your friends membership and you've been a little too busy and you got drawn into this bumblebee conversation, which is really great, by the way, Chris, then this would be a perfect moment for you to call 888-694-6931. Or to go to kera.org and make that contribution. Everybody who gives today, and really up until today, but we're actually offering you a fantastic opportunity. Chris, we're going to have a huge drawing tomorrow.
This is going to be really exciting. We are giving away to one person who has become a member or renewed a membership, and you will be in the drawing if you do that now. Two tickets to see Neil deGrasse Tyson at the Winsper Opera House. I believe it's on May 19th.
May 19th, yeah.
And a $1,000 Apple Store gift card to the same lucky winner. We would love to put your name in there, and that's exactly what will happen when you make a contribution now at 888-694-6931 or kera.org.
Yeah, the Winspear show is sold out, by the way, so you can't go get tickets. Well, you could probably find them on a secondary market, but we're going to give a pair to the lucky winner and throw in a $1,000 Apple Store gift card. So your call right now to 888-694-6931 will help us not only make this challenge from Robert Verdon, Dallas attorney, but also get you into the running for the grand prize drawing for the membership drive, which, by the way, ends tomorrow.
That's right. And this is the perfect time for you to make a contribution. Thank you so much, Misty and Ethan Wisely in Denton. Thank you, Patrick Higgins in Dallas. Thank you, Richard Holbein in Dallas. I think Richard is our new friend, it looks like, with the asterisk there.
I think that's...
Yes. Okay, good.
And it's probably Holbein.
Holbein, yeah. Pardon me. Yes.
But thank you so much, Richard. Yeah, and we... it looks like... am I correct? It looks like we've made the... Chris?
Made the challenge.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Oh, my goodness. Thanks to all of you who have made this happen. It's been an exciting couple of hours. But if you were on the line, please go through with your contribution.
Don't hang up. Keep hanging in there. Keep if you're on KERA.org right now filling out the membership donation form, please don't stop because we made this challenge. We want to thank Robert Verdon, a Dallas attorney, friend of KERA, for making this $1,500 challenge today. Since we raised over $10,000, we're able to accept his generous contribution, an additional contribution of $1,500. So thank you so much, Robert. We would love to thank you when you call 888-694-6931 or when you contribute at kera.org. Of course, we're all going toward the successful conclusion of this membership campaign tomorrow. And it's really only a success when everybody who listens, everybody who believes that public radio is important in North Texas, takes a little piece of ownership, takes a little piece of the responsibility for making sure that this service is here for you every single day.
Maybe your contribution simply pays for you and your family, but maybe it also pays for that student who is working their way through school, uses KERA as a source of learning and ideas and a way to fulfill curiosity about the world. Your contribution does something for you and also for your community.
Yeah, it's really valuable resource. I think everybody who listens would agree. But there are just a few of you who give to the station, and we're hoping that you will make the decision to go ahead and pick up that phone and call 888-694-6931. We've got copies of Dave Goulson's book, A Sting in the Tail, about it's his adventures with bumblebees. I love that when he was telling the story of how he had to sit in a meadow for 5 years and watch bees land on flowers before they really figured out exactly what was. I mean, you know, what an amazing story this guy has. And I had no idea. I had no idea that all of the, as he says, tomatoes that we eat are pollinated by bumblebees.
Thank you, bumblebees. I'm a big fan of tomatoes tomatoes. And it's nice to know that somebody is, you know, paying attention to this stuff and wants the world to be in a good position. I always love, you know, we love talking to scientists on the show because they're so passionate about their work. And I learn something every time. I hope that you learn something every time. Your contributions make it possible for there to be a show where we spend an hour talking about something as seemingly insignificant and truly globally significant as bumblebees.
Yeah, we talk about climate change and environmental issues, and we talk about extinctions and you know, the importance of diversity in the natural world on this show quite a bit because we know it's important to you. Where else do you find an hour-long conversation about the bumblebee?
Your contribution makes it possible. You become a benefactor of Think and of KERA at 1-888-694-6931 or at kera.org. We really, really appreciate so many of you who have stepped up in the past 2 hours. And if you are still waiting to make a contribution, don't wait because we are still working on the rest of our goals.
Yeah, we want to wrap this drive up successfully tomorrow. But in the meantime, thank you very, very much. If you have given to the station during the drive or during today, thank you very, very much.